CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am joined by Brandon. We're going to be talking about Friedrich Nietzsche. We're going to take some time initially in this episode to kind of introduce him and also introduce how he is relevant slash kind of not relevant. I would presume that most of you out there, even if you're not very into philosophy or whatever, you would recognize the name Nietzsche. He is, without a question, one of the most famous writers, thinkers, philosophers, early psychologists of the late 20th century. Many people would say that, you know, modern psychology was sort of birthed from his writings as like a discipline. And he's had a really outsized effect on philosophy as well. Do you want to say a little bit about his backstory? We don't need to go too high into it, but yeah, just a little bit about who Nietzsche was, because he was a bit of an interesting guy, to say the least.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, Nietzsche initially, I don't have the order specifically, but I know that he was involved. He had a military involvement for some time, and then eventually became a professor of philology. He became a professor of philology and lectured on philosophy.
And this would be kind of like late 19th century Germany.
Yeah, so this is like mid to late 19th century Germany. So he had a professorship at the University of Basel, and he wrote a treatise on Greek tragedy that was quite polarizing at the time. And he was considered very promising. He was a bright scholar, but with this work, he kind of set himself out to be not so bright to the German academic world. Yeah, to the German establishment. It was a radical departure from the way that they viewed the Greeks at the time. They saw the Greeks as, you know, the West's youth, as kind of springly and sweet. But he said that there was necessarily this kind of Dionysian dark undertones to them, and he tried to balance those out. And from there, he more or less continues to write increasingly unpopular, but more and more psychologically penetrating and more inward turning and more critical essays. He was always a convalescent. His health was never great. So eventually he did end up losing his sanity. And I don't know how long he was insane for, but it was quite an extended period of time before he actually,
I think it was the last decade of his life. And as has already been stated at the beginning, we're going to be focusing on his work, Twilight of the Idols, which is, for our listeners, great title. Just a fantastic, Nietzsche was a fantastic titleist.
Yeah, he was. So this is one thing that we should say just right off the bat, that if you're used to reading philosophy, you are used to having to keep your, you know, pull the scotch tape out to keep your eyes open, right? Because philosophy can be a bit dry, a bit academic. It can be a bit fatiguing even. I've always said this about Nietzsche. I've never been able to read a passage of Nietzsche sitting down. You have to stand up. You have to pace around like an animal. You have to really get into it. There's something energizing about reading Nietzsche. He knows how to use language to evoke not just feelings or rhetorically like persuade someone. He actually can affect you. It's stunning the way he's able to do that. I think it explains a bit of his popularity.
It highlights his, as you say, his kind of popularity or his pull or why. Because from my understanding as well, like you said, like Nietzsche was a complicated character, because he did serve in the War of 1871 between France and Prussia. And he was a medical orderly, but apparently he served with some distinction and was a very capable medical orderly in combat and all this kind of stuff. So not like a frontline fighter, but right behind the lines, you know, picking up wounded soldiers back and forth. It's still a relatively dangerous job and obviously quite traumatic. And apparently he did that job quite well. And he was also apparently quite an accomplished horseback rider, although, as you said, he was a convalescent. And I think there's some connection between him having quite a severe horse riding accident when he was young that really led to him losing a lot of his physical abilities. And so this kind of, this you know, some we don't talk always necessarily much about the personal lives of the philosophers recovering. Many times, because there's not that much info, Nietzsche is one of those people who, you know, people have written a plethora of biographies. He's one of the big names, right? Like, it's interesting to look at his work within the context of his physical health and ability, because as you said, he was a convalescent most of his life. I think he spent a lot of time in Italy, spas and seasides and warmer climates and just kind of writing and not doing much, which really is transposed a lot against the kinds of characters and ideals that he writes about as being worthwhile. If you read Nietzsche, you wouldn't expect him to basically be like an invalid type guy. So that's like another, that's more of like a meta sort of like what's going on with Nietzsche in terms of like, why is he writing like this and thinking like this when he's someone who seems unlikely to be the kind of, as the, we'll get into those sorts of terms, but like the kind of the overman, the ubermensch or whatever, right? Like this great figure of strength and power and strength and of excess, as he would say. But he certainly had strength of excess of mind. He really, really was influential on the burgeoning psychological movement with people like Freud.
Freud had several students. The two main successors are Alfred Adler and Carl Jung.
Carl Jung. Jung was the one I was thinking of as well, where, you know, you see Nietzsche coming up a lot in this. But he's not, as we get into him, and that's kind of why we wanted to pick Twilight, there's two things going on. One, he's not really a systematic thinker. Like if we were to pick up, you know, a work by, what's a great example of a systematic work? Kant. If we were to pick up the Critique of Pure Reason, which is almost unreadable, it's written like a technical philosophical document. It has an overarching focus, claims, arguments, and they all sort of weave together and are really focused on elucidating some aspect of reality that otherwise would not be possible. Nietzsche kind of reverses this and is more a philosopher who is critical of philosophers, critical of aesthetic movements, critical of values, you know, not really replacing it with anything else, but instead more or less saying the project that all of these people back to, right back to Socrates, that they've been doing is a failure. They've been stuck on the wrong path. They have the wrong focuses. They didn't know what they were doing. They came across good things here or there, but really the whole thing is kind of broken and misguided. And so what you get reading with Nietzsche, what I got reading, you know, I'm most of the way through Twilight of the Idols, and I'll say it's been a long time since I've read Nietzsche. I've never been a big Nietzsche scholar, but for our listeners, I will say I have thoroughly enjoyed reading Twilight. It's a philosophy, first philosophy book in a while, where I've been quite impressed and quite engrossed. Nietzsche is a fantastic writer. There's no question about that. He's one of the best writers of the 19th century. And I think as we're going to get into now, he writes not at face value. You know, we could have done an episode for you where we go through Twilight and we go through the main points and blah, 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 blah. And we're going to do a little bit of that. But I think also we want our main focus to be, how does Nietzsche, someone like Nietzsche, very craftily come up with a work like Twilight of the Idols that, you know, you could give a cursory reading as just cultural criticism and kind of scan through or whatever. But really, if you do that, you are missing a whole lot more, because every line, every word, every page break, every section, the kind of weird stuff that he does, it all has meaning. Nothing in this book is left up to chance, which means that it's extremely, it's the kind of philosophical work that you could hand to someone and say, oh, here's some kind of difficult philosophy. Why don't you read this? And they could kind of read through it and get maybe some gists, some ideas, some pithy quotes and be like, oh, yeah, I got it. But they would actually be missing 98% of what Nietzsche is getting at and what he's trying to do.
Even just being made aware of this particular way of reading or approaching Nietzsche kind of makes the, you know, just the like summary kind of episode where we go through it section by section, point for point, and we try and talk about what Nietzsche is talking about here. It makes that difficult, if not impossible, if you're brought to this awareness that actually there is like a particular way, not just that Nietzsche is to be read, but that since Nietzsche wrote in a certain way, he needs to be read, and not just read, but kind of even listened to. One of the metaphors that Tracy Strong, we're going to refer to Tracy Strong's introduction a good bit and maybe some other works, the way that he talks about making the words your own flesh, the way that you, when you read a text, you come to your own understanding of it. The particular way that Nietzsche is setting out his text is such that the reader should be reading it and having a critical relationship to the text itself, right? Now, what that looks like and what that means, we'll go into more detail, but the point is that, the point is to say right now that we could, again, just go through Twilight of the Idols, and that, I think that would make a great episode, and, you know, there's lots to talk about there. But if you really want to open up Twilight of the Idols, or if you really want to open up any of Nietzsche's particular text, becoming aware of this almost like musical way of listening to Nietzsche is, it's going to make other ways of reading it possible, and it's going to make your own reading of it much more, I think, to anticipate a bit more transformative and more what Nietzsche actually aims for his text to do to his readers.
Yeah, and to that point, before we get into it, I think we were talking before, it's probably worth it for a reader to talk a little bit about Nietzsche in modernity, Nietzsche today, because Nietzsche is one of the most famous philosophers consistently. He's one of those few philosophers where if you ask pretty much anyone on the street if they've at least heard of Nietzsche, they'd say yes, right? If I ask most people on the street, hey, do you know who Heidegger is, or Locke, or, you know, I don't know, like Du Beauvoir or something? Husserl, deeper, right? What was that guy, like Plotinus? Everybody knows Plotinus, right? But Nietzsche is someone that the general public does know. But because of his sort of pithy saying, his extremely strong grasp of rhetoric, what's happened with Nietzsche is he's been very much co-opted into the kind of what I would call the sort of content, like philosophy as content world that you see primarily online. And I actually screenshotted this from my Facebook the other day, got recommended to me. And I don't follow that much philosophy stuff, but it came up on some inspirational thing that I get recommended to, because apparently I'm in deep need of spiritual, you know, engagement or whatever. So says the meta overlords. And it's a photo of, this is a radio show, so I won't show it, but it's a photo of Nietzsche. And it just says below, in quotes, most people are not seeking truth. They are searching for comfort in illusions, Friedrich Nietzsche. So a couple things about this. I see this stuff all the time online. I'm sure many of you have seen things like this before. First off, as a little kind of interesting note, revealing, the photo that's frequently used for these is Nietzsche with that huge bristly beard and all that kind of stuff. Those are photos from Nietzsche after he had his mental breakdown. So those are photos from Nietzsche who was not the Nietzsche that was writing these things. That he basically, you could see it almost like a split in personality, a split in personhood. He had a severe mental breakdown. I do believe, don't quote me on this, but there's some suspicion that it was actually related to syphilis that basically got in his brain, and he became comatose and completely non-functioning for the last decade of his life. Which is ironic, because that was also the same time that his work really started to pick up. So people, these sorts of things often almost always use this image of Nietzsche, for some reason, perhaps because it's, you know, it's very the mustache and all that.
Yeah, I think it has. I think it has to do with the sort of stern, and it looks, his stare looks very serious. His face is very, yeah, he's got crazy eyes. I mean, that's a good way of putting it. His beard is very huge. He's kind of like, you can see him like slouched over, but you can project onto this crazy-eyed person the ideals that he's espousing.
And then if it goes down to the quote, most people are not seeking truth, they are searching for comfort and illusions. Okay, so from you and I reading most of Twilight of the Idols and being a little familiar, there is a sense in which this quote is technically true. The issue is that you are not going to get the truth out of this quote, because there is a whole bunch of, you know, basically preamble to different concepts within this quote, things around truth, seeking, and in particularly the search for comfort in illusions. Like, you know, so if you're reading this, what happens is, as just a general Joe Smo on the social media, you know, you sort of, this is ripe for what I would call deeply subjective interpretation, which becomes almost meaningless, because it's just like, oh, well, illusions in my life, like, you know, how I think my life is just pretending to be in love with me. And it's like, that's not, he's not talking about that at all, right? Like, that's not, this is not what he's talking about. If you just take this quote, you're not going to get the whole idea. You have no idea what's going on within the context of his work. And it's really unfortunate, but he has, probably because he is such a good writer and can kind of slap people in the face with all this stuff, he really has become this poster child of what we would call pop psychology, pop philosophy. I mean, people like Jordan Peterson at times have been big Nietzsche fans, constantly quoting Nietzsche, you know, blah, blah. And it's like, it's awfully easy to use good art and thought in ways that it was not intended to, or to contort meanings in particular ways.
Yeah. This quote in particular, I think, loans itself really well to being lifted out of its context, because when you're using a pithy quote, you want to use it for some particular purpose. And I think it needs some like node inside of the quote to attach to whatever meaning you think applies to what you're saying. And I think that node in this quote is this idea of the comfort of illusions, right? We today think that we have kind of sloughed off all illusions, or that we think that the people who are weak-willed or who are soft are just contenting. They're just wrapping themselves in blankets of illusions, when really we should be steadfast and truthful, and at no matter what cost, right? Which, if you really go back, and again, the thing is that this is lifted out of context. I'm sure that there are things surrounding it, and we'll get into why this has to be, considering the way that Strong suggests reading Nietzsche. Even just understanding a little bit of Nietzsche's philosophy in general, like, Nietzsche is not exactly like a quote-unquote truth seeker. He's very skeptical of the value of truth.
He's obviously skeptical of the value of truth. It's at least, particularly within truth, within the context of how it's been used in philosophy. I don't think Nietzsche is a nihilist. Well, actually, I know he's not a nihilist, because he rails against nihilism constantly. But there's a way in which his philosophical thinking, one could read in kind of pseudo nihilistic tendencies, because he's constantly doing a kind of deconstructivism, right? But just because you're doing deconstructivism doesn't really mean that you're nihilistic. And as a matter of fact, it's more revealing of the systems that are being deconstructed, because it's those systems that will then say, those people involved, advocates, whatever, oh, well, now there's going to be nothing. Everything is going to fall apart. If you break down liberal democracy, or if you break down monarchy, or if you break down Christian values, then it's all going to go to hell in a handbasket. You don't know what you're doing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And I think Nietzsche is saying no, right? Like, the world is in a kind of a cycle. It's in a process of organic growth. Things grow up, gardens, trees, meadows, you know, and circumstances change and they die. They lack the vitality that they once had, or they can no longer suppress the things that they were trying to suppress. And from that, new things are born. Like, I don't want to get too airy-fairy, but I think from my reading of Nietzsche, reading of Twilight of Idols, there's this kind of pawning for a sort of more organic look at the world, an organic look at time, society, culture, and individuals, where instead of trying to fit everything into, like, a neat box, the most obvious example for Nietzsche that he's going to rail against is other ones as well, but there's a Christian morality, right? The Christian morality, what we call a slave morality, it kind of overthrew, undermined kind of sneakily the sort of heroistic pagan world of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, which was already on decline, and instead incorporated values into this system that really, as Nietzsche would say, kind of harshly benefited the weak, right? You know, benefited the weak, and from that weakness also created a whole new bureaucracy system, systems of belief that sort of encapsulate, but also make it a hierarchy, this sort of hierarchy, but then encapsulate this whole new kind of world, right? And it sort of settles out, you know, in post-Roman Empire, as particularly once we get into the Middle Ages, where, you know, everybody's a Christian, right? Basically, everyone across Europe is a Christian. They basically all believe the same stuff. It's all controlled by the same people. There's very strong hierarchies going on. And what they say goes, even if it runs counter to any sort of rational thought or criticism or whatever it might be. But as Nietzsche would also say, these things become decadent, right? And I think I heard something earlier today, and I'm trying to remember it. It's not necessarily decadence, just like over indulgence. It's there is a little bit of that, but it's also decadence in a kind of over focusing, right? Like with it, we have this sort of idea that we have all of this figured out. You don't need to tell us what to do. If you're trying to, you know, basically tell us what to do or to get involved, then you are an enemy and we're going to deal with you in such and such a way. But these sorts of, this kind of decadence often leads to degeneration because it runs counter to, I think, what Nietzsche would say the most natural forces in the world are, which are these sort of organic creative forces of constant flux and change.
Yeah, that's, I mean, to go back a little bit to the accusation of Nietzsche as a nihilist, he's not a nihilist because he does think that there are, well, first of all, if there are values, they come out of what he calls life, life as a growing and always changing phenomena generates values. But what is seen as nihilistic about Nietzsche is, again, that deconstructivist tendency to want to critique and see past the illusion of eternal truths. One of those eternal truths being something like Christian morality, which bases itself on, you know, things like the permanent notion of like an immortal soul and whatnot. That's why I think that, again, going back to his really well-crafted titles, it's already a critique of Christian morality to call his text The Genealogy of Morality, because only things that grow and emerge have genealogies. So to simply say that actually this idea of permanence, it didn't come from, it hasn't always been there, right? This had to have come from somewhere. And guess what? That idea can change. That idea can decline. And it's in decline now, Nietzsche would say, right? And if we're just honest about the changing nature of these beliefs, rather than treating them as immutable truths, we actually have a better understanding of how these moralities work, how these moralities will change over time. So it's what allows Nietzsche to seem prescient, is that he had a better, you know, finger on the pulse, as it were, as far as morality, because the Christian morality that bases itself on just trying to hold on to eternal truths is up against the forces of change that underlie the phenomena of morality.
It's probably worthwhile to talk a little bit about what are some of the structures in Twilight of the Idols, right? Like we could do for listeners, we could easily do a multi-part episode just on the work Twilight of the Idols, even though it's 80 pages. There's a lot of good stuff going on in there. But there are some structural themes that are really important. One of them, maybe you could talk a little bit more about this, is that, and this is the kind of stuff for listeners that if you jump into Nietzsche, it's easy to miss. And we really recommend, I know sometimes this could be annoying, but for books like this, read the introduction. Read the notes done by the translator, because that will elucidate you on what kind of book you're reading, because it's really not like picking up just any kind of novel or textbook or whatever, right? But I think the best one is your better sense is the literal poetic meter that the book is set in. That is very easy to miss if you are not familiar with.
Yeah. So the book is written almost like poetry. I mean, when I was in liberal studies and I was taught to read poetry, I didn't get to learn to read it for very long. But one of the things that I was taught was that poetry resists paraphrase, right? So the meaning of a poem is difficult to convey in words other than the ones the poem itself uses, right? That's what makes it poetic. It's these particular words. It's why Nietzsche had to be such a meticulous writer, why he was all constantly shopping different titles, different subtitles, playing with different words. He is trying to craft something that only gets across the meaning that it can get across with the words that it does in fact use, right? This also goes to explain why when you take quotes out of context, you lift them from the exact place in which those words have the exact meaning that they have. So it's really important when you are approaching Nietzsche for the first time to carefully examine how you arrived at this particular passage that you might be animated by or interested in. And not only that, but what does it anticipate? What does it establish? What does it make possible later on? What you're looking for here is resonances, right? Places in the text where one part of the text speaks to another part of the text. And the way that, say, Nietzsche talking about the philosophers and their sort of obsession with permanence, and the way that that later on, the way that that relates to, say, Christian morality, right? Because Christians and philosophers as sects, as groups of people, have not always been the same, but they share common values. And by putting these two together, you kind of hear the sounds and notes between what Nietzsche is trying to say, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's an interrelation between the different parts, right? That's the big one. It's a hard thing even for myself to kind of recognize. I'm not like,
it's such a different way of reading a text that it's still foreign to me. I even sometimes wonder like, okay, is this not just like playing with words in order to, you know, to just be poetic? Like, okay, say we have a text and it, you know, these two parts ring true together or they have some relation. Okay, that's interesting. It makes for like a poetically intertwined book. What's really difficult for people who are not used to reading works in this kind of resonant way is, okay, well, how does this act? Like, what's the cash value of this? How do we actually cash this out as far as Nietzsche trying to do something philosophically? Are we just mistaking Nietzsche as a philosopher when really he's just a poet? Or does this use of poetic meter actually involve is it actually involved in his philosophical project? I think it is, but it's difficult if you're not used to reading in this way what that value is.
Yeah, exactly. And